Pull up a chair. I want you to imagine a lake in Germany. It's the middle of the night, the 16th of May, 1943. There's a moon up, a full one, laying a silver stripe right across the black water. It's quiet. And then out of the dark, low, so low the prop wash is tearing the surface into spray, comes a four-engine bomber doing better than 200 miles an hour at 60 feet off the deck. 60 feet. That's lower than the trees on the shoreline. That's a pilot flying at the height of a six-story building with a whole valley trying to kill him. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar. Today we're going to talk about one of the boldest, strangest, most beautifully engineered raids in the whole history of military flying. The night the Royal Air Force went after the dams of the Ruhr with a weapon that had no business working, they called it Operation Chastise. Everybody else calls them the Dambusters. And before we get into it, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on here in the hangar today. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And friends, the story we're telling today is exactly the kind that ought to live in your pocket. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, let me set the scene properly. By 1943, the boys in Bomber Command had been throwing everything they had at German industry, and it was slow, bloody going. The heart of that industry was the Ruhr Valley. Steel, coal factories running day and night to feed the war machine. And all of that industry drank water, rivers of it held back by big masonry dams up in the hills. There was a man named Barnes Wallace, an engineer. Not a young, dashing pilot type, mind you. A quiet, stubborn, brilliant fellow with round spectacles and a slide rule. The kind of man who worries a problem like a dog worries a bone. And Wallace had gotten it into his head that if you could crack those dams, you'd flood the valley, wreck the factories, and knock out the water and power the Germans needed to make war. Here's the trouble. You cannot just drop a bomb on a dam. Now here's where it gets interesting. A dam is a wall of stone and concrete, maybe 130 feet thick at the base. A bomb hitting the top does almost nothing. A bomb landing in the water nearby just makes a splash, because water absorbs the blast. What you needed was to get a charge right up against the face of that dam, down deep below the waterline, so the water itself would tamp the explosion and channel all that force into the masonry. Same reason a depth charge kills a submarine. The water does the work. But how in the world do you place a bomb against the underwater face of a dam at night from an airplane? The Germans knew the dams were valuable, so they'd strung heavy torpedo nets across the water in front of them. You couldn't run a torpedo in. It'd snag on the nets and blow up short. Barnes Wallace sat with that problem, and he came up with something out of a schoolboy's daydream. He remembered skipping stones across a pond, flat rock, low angle, and it dances across the surface, one skip, two skips, three. And he thought, what if a bomb could do that? What if you could skip a bomb across the top of the lake right over the torpedo nets until it kissed the face of the dam, lost its momentum, and rolled straight down the wall to the right depth before it went off? They tell the story that he tested the idea by firing marbles across a tub of water in his own back garden. A grown man, a serious engineer, flicking marbles across the water and measuring how they bounced. That's the birth of it. The weapon he built was called Upkeep. Now forget everything you picture when you hear the word bomb. This thing was a great steel drum, roughly 5 feet across, weighing about 9,000 pounds. Most of that a high explosive called Torpex. And here's the clever part. Before the crew dropped it, a little hydraulic motor in the belly of the airplane would spin that drum backwards, spin it up to around 500 revolutions a minute, backspin. Same thing that makes a golf ball check up on the green. That backspin did two things. On the way across the water, it kept the drum skipping true instead of veering off. And when it hit the dam and rolled down the face, the spin actually held it snug against the wall all the way down, like a kid's toy climbing a wall in reverse. Then a hydrostatic pistol, a pressure fuse, the very same idea as a depth charge, would fire it at 30 feet down. It was genius, and it was almost impossible to deliver, because for that skipping trick to work, the physics had to be perfect. The airplane had to be at exactly 60 feet above the water, not 80, not 40, 60, and it had to be at exactly 232 miles an hour, and it had to release the weapon at exactly the right distance from the dam, no closer, no farther. Get any one of those wrong at night, over water, with the enemy shooting at you, and the whole thing was for nothing. Now think about what that asks of a pilot. Flying at 60 feet in daylight over a runway, with a radar altimeter, is a handful. These men were doing it at night, over glassy black water, with 1943 instruments. And here's the thing, every pilot listening will feel in their gut. Over smooth water in the dark, you cannot judge your height. Your eyes lie to you, there's no texture, no shadow, nothing to tell you if you're at 60 feet or 6. Pilots have flown perfectly good airplanes straight into calm water because their eyes swore they were higher than they were. So how'd they solve it? Not with fancy electronics, with a carpenter's trick. Somebody, and the story gives the credit around, came up with the idea of mounting two spotlights under the airplane, one in the nose, one in the belly, angled so their two beams would come together into a single spot of light on the water at exactly 60 feet. Higher than 60, and you'd see two separate pools of light, lower, and they'd cross. When those two circles slid together into a perfect figure eight on the water, you were dead on 60 feet. A navigator would lie there watching the light out the blister and call it out. Up a bit, down a bit, steady, steady, and for the range to the dam, even simpler. They cut a little handheld wooden triangle, a Y-shaped bit of plywood with a nail in each tip. The bomb aimer would hold it up to his eye, and when the two towers on top of the dam lined up with the two nails, that was your release point, a schoolboy's plywood gun sight. That's how they aimed a 9,000-pound bouncing bomb. Back when AVGs was cheap and airspace was free, we solved hard problems with plywood and a good idea. Sometimes I think we've forgotten that. Now they needed men to fly it and a squadron to fly it in. They stood up a brand new outfit, number 617 Squadron, from scratch, and they picked the crews from the best in Bomber Command. To lead it, they chose a 24-year-old named Guy Gibson, 24 years old, and he'd already flown something like 170 operations, bombers and night fighters, both a hard-driven young man with an old man's mileage on him. They trained for weeks and had no idea what for. Low flying, over and over, across the lakes and reservoirs of England, down in the weeds until the farmers were furious and the training command was getting complaints. 60 feet again and again, until it was muscle memory. Most of them didn't learn the target until the final briefing. The airplane was the Avro Lancaster. And oh, what an airplane. If you've never stood under a Lank, put it on your list before you die. Four Rolls-Royce Merlin engines. That gorgeous supercharged growl. The same engine family that powered the Spitfire and the Mustang. A big, honest, slab-sided bomber with a huge bomb bay. Except these Lancasters were special. They'd been cut down and modified. The bomb bay doors were gone. The mid-upper gun turret was gone, all to save weight, and to hang that great spinning drum underneath on a pair of arms. The night of the raid, they launched 19 Lancasters in three waves. Roughly 133 men climbed into those airplanes. Average age, low 20s, boys really. They crossed the North Sea and the Dutch coast right down on the deck under the radar, weaving between the flak batteries. And low flying isn't a free ride. It's terrifying and it's deadly. One airplane hit the sea and lost its bomb. One clipped high tension power lines, one flew into the ground. Men died on the way in before they ever saw a dam, and the ones that made it threaded power lines and church steeples in the moonlight the whole way there. The primary target was the Moni Dam. Gibson got there first, and he did something that tells you everything about the man. He flew in alone, first to draw the fire and show the others the run, down to 60 feet, spotlights on, which meant every gunner on that dam could see exactly where he was. Full power, straight down the moonlit water. The navigator calling the height, the bomb aimer lining up the plywood, the flak coming up in ropes of tracer. His bomb bounced true and hit the dam. And the dam held, so he did it again. He came back around and flew alongside the next airplane on its run, drawing the guns onto himself to take the heat off his man. Then another airplane, and another one, got hit and blew up. It took five of those bombs, five runs down that terrible stretch of water, before the Moni Dam finally shuttered, cracked, and let go. They say the water came through the breach like a living thing. A wall of it, maybe 30 feet high, tearing down the valley in the moonlight, carrying away everything in its path. One of the crews radioed back the code word for success, and there was cheering on the radio, grown men whooping in the dark over Germany. But they weren't done. Gibson gathered the airplanes that still had bombs and led them onto the Eder Dam, deeper in, tucked down in a valley so steep and twisted that just getting a Lancaster lined up on the water was a feat of flying all its own. They had to dive over a castle on a hilltop, drop into the valley, get down to 60 feet, get the speed exactly right, release, and then firewall four Merlins and haul that heavy bomber up over the far hills before they hit them. Some crews made three, four, five attempts before they could even get the run right. The Eder broke too. A third dam, the Sorpe, was built differently, an earthen dam, and it took a pounding but held. But two of the great dams of the Ruhr were gone, and the water was running loose across the valley. Now, I have to tell you the other side of the ledger because a good hangar story tells the truth. That night cost dear. Of the 19 Lancasters that went out, 8 did not come home. 53 of those young men were killed. 53 in one night out of 133. Do that arithmetic and it stops you cold. And down in the valleys, the flood killed well over 1,000 people on the ground. Many of them not even German, a lot of them prisoners and forced laborers penned in a camp below the Moon. War is like that, it never comes clean. Did it win the war? No. The Germans were tough and resourceful, and they had the Moon patched up and pumping water again by that autumn. The dams didn't stay down. But here's why we still talk about it in this hangar, 80-some years on. It wasn't really about the water. It was about what a determined mind and a brave crew can do when they refuse to accept that a thing is impossible. A quiet engineer flicking marbles across a tub in his garden, a gun sight cut from plywood, two spotlights and a carpenter's trick to fly at 60 feet in the dark, and young men who trained for something they weren't allowed to know, and then flew it straight down the barrel of the guns because they were asked to. Guy Gibson got the Victoria Cross for leading that raid. He went on flying, when by every right he'd earned a desk, and he was killed in 1944, still in the air, still doing the job. Barnes Wallace, they say, wept when he learned how many of the crews didn't come back. He never forgot that his good idea was paid for in those boys. When you see a Lancaster fly today, and there are only a precious couple left flying in the whole world, listen to those four Merlins and think about that night. Think about 60 feet in the dark over the water, with the two spotlights sliding together into one. My thanks tonight to the Royal Air Force Museum and the historians of 617 Squadron, whose records keep this story straight, and to the memory of the men who flew it. You can find us at radiohangar.com. Go read a little more about those crews. They earned the remembering. This is Tail Dragger. Keep the shiny side up, and don't ever let anybody tell you it can't be done. Somebody's probably already skipped a marble across a tub to prove them wrong.